Shalom Haravarnix. Welcome to our next session in the First Regathering, Zionism and Modern Israel. I'd like to begin this session by reviewing the entire course really quickly, doing a quick review of where we were from the beginning. And we began in Section 1, which dealt with the spiritual war, some introductory material. We moved to Section 2, which was background material, an historical survey of the period from 66 AD to 1839 AD. Then we moved into Section 3, the end of exile, 1839 to 1947, which dealt with the modern Zionist movement. Now we're in Section 4, the State of Israel, 1948 to the present. And a good subtitle for this section would be The Unending War, 1948 to the present, because Israel has been at war now for some 71 years. And yet, in spite of this constant warfare that has attacked the country, she has flourished and she has become one of the most influential nations on the face of the earth. How did that happen? How is that possible? Has that happened with any other nation? Of course, the answer is no. But how is it possible? Well, in the words of David Ben-Gurion, in Israel, in order to be a realist, you need to believe in miracles. It's God's overriding hand. God's overriding hand has prospered this nation. All right, so now we're at the First Regathering, Zionism and Modern Israel, Session 13, as we begin Israel present. We begin with the 1948 proclamation of the State of Israel. At 8 o'clock in the morning, on May 14th, 1948, the British lowered the Union Jack in Jerusalem, and the mandate was terminated. And here is the Palestine termination of the mandate, the official British document publication on termination. It provided an historical assessment of the mandate and the reasons for its termination. You can find it on Wikipedia if you'd like to read it. This is a flag lowering ceremony in Haifa, not in Jerusalem, but this is the British as they got ready to leave the port city of Haifa. They lowered the Union Jack as they began to move out, and the termination was and the mandate was terminated. By mid-afternoon, however, full-scale fighting had erupted throughout the country. At 4 o'clock, the Jewish population, except for Jerusalem, ironically enough, Jerusalem was without electricity. At 4 o'clock, the entire Jewish population heard the proclamation ceremonies as they were broadcast from the Tel Aviv Museum. David Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel. Here's that very famous picture of Ben-Gurion reading the Declaration. Here is another photograph, a close-up of him reading the Declaration. And then Ben-Gurion signing the Declaration of Independence. And this is the view of the Declaration of Independence. Only a few of the many paragraphs are in view in this slide. And I will just read the first two paragraphs for you in English. The land of Israel was the birthplace of the Jewish people. Here her spiritual, religious, and political identity was shaped. Here they first attained to statehood, created cultural values of national and universal significance, and gave to the world the eternal book of books. After being forcibly exiled from their land, the people kept faith with it throughout their dispersion and never ceased to pray and to hope for their return to it and for the restoration of it and for the restoration in it of their political freedom. And of course, the Declaration goes on for quite a bit longer. And this is the headlines, very famous headlines of the Palestine Post. The State of Israel is born. Now, this is the Palestine Post. Please note the name. Both Jews and Arabs living in the area were known as Palestinians in those days. So this is the Palestine Post. But its name has been updated. Currently is known as the Jerusalem Post. And so if you would like to subscribe to the Jerusalem Post, it is quite available. This is the JP website, www.jpost.com. And you can stay abreast of all the news in Jerusalem from this historic newspaper in electronic form. Now, immediately after adopting the Declaration of Independence, the Council of State unanimously passed an ordinance abolishing the White Paper of 1939. In other words, no more restrictions on immigration or land purchase were allowed. No restrictions anymore. The United States then recognized Israel on May 14, 1948. President Truman decided to extend recognition immediately, and the announcement was issued at 6:10 p.m. Six Arab states invade. The Arab nations had discussed the possibility of an armed invasion as early as June 9, 1946. However, the aim of each Arab country was different. Abdullah of Transjordan's ambition was primarily to extend his dynasty to the Arab sector of the UN plan. He was willing to arrange his own deal with the Jews for the rest of the country. Now, the Syrians were determined to seize as much of it as they could, as much of the northern Palestine as they could. The Mufti's aims were the most straightforward and simplest of all. Remember Haj Amin al-Husseini? He's the good buddy of Hitler, met with Hitler during World War II. His aims were to drive the Jews out of Palestine and rule the country. Then the rest, Lebanon, Iraq, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, by and large, were not interested in intervention. The Arab blueprint for invasion therefore deteriorated into a loose understanding that the Iraqis would enter north-central Palestine on the flank of the Arab Legion. The Syrian brigade would enter southeast of Tiberias, while the far northern sector would be left to the Lebanese divisions. The Egyptians would be responsible for the southern half of Palestine. So here is the Arab blueprint for invasion. In the south, we have Egypt taking care of the south. Then as we move north, Jordan would advance across the Jordan River and attack Jerusalem. The center of the country would be invaded by Iraq. Moving a little more north, Syria would take care of the northern and eastern sectors of Palestine. The Arab Liberation Army would take care of the northernmost sector of Palestine. And then finally, number six, the Lebanese would take the northwestern sector of Palestine. So this was the original blueprint. Now, the belligerents in the war on Israel's side before 26th of May 1948, the Arab army was made up of the Haganah, the Palmach, the Irgun, and the Lehi. But after 26 May 1948, it had all been reorganized into the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, and then there was a minorities unit. The Arab states that were involved in the war are Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, the All-Palestine Army, and the Lebanese Army. And then two irregular armies, the Holy War Army and the Arab Liberation Army. So these are the belligerents. And here is the logo of the Arab Liberation Army. And of course, you can see their aim, a dagger through the heart of the Jewish community. Now, on May 14th, Abdullah appointed himself as commander-in-chief by virtue of his army's recognized military superiority in the Arab world. They had a lot of training and help from Britain. So they had a very strong army. Now, his title was purely honorific. Coordination among the various Arab armies was non-existent. The Arabs would have been considerably less hesitant to invade Palestine had they known the actual state of the Jewish defenses. As late as May 12th, the Haganah mobilized barely 30,000 men and women. The number itself is not that much smaller than the total Arab forces on the Palestine front. The Arab forces consisted of approximately 10,000 Egyptians, 4,500 Arabs, Arab legionnaires, I should say, 7,000 Syrians, 8,000 Iraqis, and 3,000 Lebanese, for a total of about 32,500. So the two forces in manpower were pretty equal, but the Arab strength was concentrated primarily in much greater firepower and in air forces that were at their disposal. And at the beginning of the war, the Israelis had nothing comparable to that. nothing comparable to the Arab firepower. The Jews' most important resource was to be found in dedication and military experience of the troops, not to mention, of course, the Lord's gracious oversight. Now, Yigal Yadin was Israel's commander of operations. On May 14th, Jewish manpower resources were critically limited, and so was the supply of weapons. On May 16th, 2 days later, a Syrian column of 200 armed vehicles, including 45 tanks, moved toward the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. The target was the cluster of lush and prosperous Jewish settlements on both sides of the Jordan River. Several of these settlements were overrun. The column then proceeded to attack the Ganya, the oldest kibbutz in Israel. And you can see the Ganya is up in the north, tucked there just below the Sea of Galilee. This is the Ganya. So the Arab armies came down from the Golan Heights. That yellow arrow came down from the Golan Heights in order to take that area of Palestine and Degania, in this place, Degania itself. Now, here is an aerial view of Kibbutz Degania, and you can see that it is tucked there comfortably up against the Sea of Galilee. Now, without artillery, Jewish forces were helpless to block the Syrian advance. Until then, the only heavy weapons that had been unloaded at Haifa were four howitzers of the type used by the French army in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. These were 80-year-old mortars. So two of these ancient field pieces were promptly dismantled and rushed to Degania. The local commander, Lieutenant Colonel Moshe Dayan, had them reassembled at the very moment the first Syrian tanks rumbled through the kibbutz perimeter. They fired and scored a direct hit on the advanced tank. Now, had the Syrians known that these two obsolete weapons represented half the arsenal of Jewish field guns in Israel, they might have pressed the attack. Instead, the armored vehicle swung around in their tracks and clattered back up the mountain road, back up the Golan Heights. They never returned. Now, if you visit the Ganya today, guess what you'll see? You'll see that Syrian tank on display. That tank that was hit by the first obsolete mortar shell. Now, the Iraqis proved only barely more effective than the Syrians. Their contingent, stationed in Transjordan near the frontier, numbered 8,000, of which 3,500 were actual combat troops. An effort was launched across the Jordan River opposite Beit Shan, the day of the mandate ended, but it failed. 5 days later, however, a Jewish frontal attack on Jenin was driven back by Iraqi reinforcements. A second Jewish effort failed 2 days later. Now, remarkably, the Iraqis were unwilling to counterattack. From then on, until the truce of June 11, they simply held on to their earlier positions. Had they continued their offensive in the early days of the war, they might have well cut the newborn state in half. Enthusiasm for battle was noticeably lacking among the Iraqi peasant conscripts. There were instances where the Jews found dead Iraqi gunners chained to their weapons, chained to keep them at their positions, chained to keep them from fleeing. The most crucial battle areas of the war proved to be in the south, along the Egyptian line of invasion up the coast, and in the Judean hills, where the Arab Legion laid siege to Jerusalem. Now, Brigadier Mohammed Naguib was the commander of the 2nd Egyptian Brigade. Naguib commanded 5,000 troops and proceeded cautiously up the coastal road toward Tel Aviv. The Egyptians encountered unexpectedly stiff resistance from the isolated kibbutz of Yad Mordechai. And here is Yad Mordechai. The Egyptians under Naguib traveled up the coastal road, and then they ran smack dab into kibbutz Yad Mordechai. And if you visit Yad Mordechai these days, you will see a memorial to the battle. In the distance, you can see metal cutouts, metal silhouettes of Egyptian soldiers attacking Yad Mordechai's defenses. Yad Mordechai withstood 6 days of intensive shelling by the Egyptians before being evacuated. And those 6 days tied up approximately half of Naguib's coastal force and mauled one of his battalions so thoroughly that it had to be temporarily deactivated. You can read about the 6 days of Yad Mordechai in Margaret Larkin's book. It's good reading, available on Amazon.com. And again, if you visit Yad Mordechai, you'll see the remnants of this battle still in place. This is the water tower with the damage it sustained during the 6 days of Yad Mordechai. Now, several miles away, another kibbutz, Negba, was blocking the Egyptian advance with equally ferocious resistance. The Egyptian, Naguib, eventually decided to skirt the bristling farm community, and Negba remained a continual threat to his flank. He moved with elaborate caution, slowing his drive 16 miles from the outskirts of Tel Aviv. At this time, Yadin decided to risk a tactical offensive. On May 29th, he ordered reinforcements from the Jerusalem corridor to circle Naguib's positions at night and attack the Egyptians from the rear. With a troop strength of barely half that of the invaders, the relief force nevertheless found darkness and surprise very, very effective. The Egyptians were thrown into confusion. They were confused by the unexpected descent by the Jewish community, by the Jewish army on their flank. Yadin exploited the disarray by calling a press conference, and he announced that the Egyptian supply lines had been cut by overwhelming concentrations of Israeli troops. The news was immediately dispatched over the international wire services and eventually reached Cairo. As Yadin had hoped, the Egyptian high command accepted the story at face value and radioed Naguib to pull up short. The bewildered commander dutifully followed orders. Naguib's setback proved to be the turning point of the Egyptian invasion. Tel Aviv was never in jeopardy again. Now, the Jewish situation in Jerusalem, besieged by the Transjordan's Arab Legion, was much more precarious. The Arabs controlled every height around the city and within the city. Their fighting strength by then was nearly 4,500 armed men. Now, while the Jewish community, if numerically their equal, were virtually without weapons. And so we come to the battle for Jerusalem. And here's a good resource for you that I would encourage you to read. O Jerusalem by Collins and LaPierre, available on Amazon.com. This details the battle for Jerusalem. Now, on May 19th, Abdullah sent his first units into the Old City. Simultaneously, an additional 2,000 legionnaires, well equipped with artillery and commanded by British officers, this is why the Arab Legion was so formidable. They were commanded by British officers. They moved on Jerusalem from the north and soon besieged its outlying perimeter. So here's the map, and they're moving on Jerusalem from the north here and besieging it along this northern perimeter at this point in time. Some of his companies, this is John Glubbs, after 10 days of savage fighting, the outnumbered Jewish troops finally managed to drive the legion back from the point of its furthest advance in the Mea Shearim quarter. So the attack was resisted very strongly there on the northern flank of Jerusalem. On May 28th, the British commander, Sir John Glubb, decided to call off the attack on the northern part of the city. Some of his companies had fully lost half of their effective strength, and others were unnerved by the shattering blast of the homemade Jewish mortars. From that point on, the Arabs switched their offensive to Jerusalem's southern approaches. On May 21st, under cover of heavy Transjordanian artillery bombardment, Egyptian infantrymen stormed the kibbutz of Ramat Rachel, lying aside the entrance to southern Jerusalem. And again, here is our map, and this is the location of Ramat Rachel, the southern part of Jerusalem, the southern entrance. What followed was the single most furious engagement of the war. The little kibbutz changed hands 5 times over the next 4 days. Soldiers pressing forward with bayonet attack often had to climb over bodies piled on top of one another. one another. And here is the battle-scarred buildings of Ramat Rachel after the war. You can see the firing there was furious. When the attack was over, the Israelis, most of them former Etzel members, remained in control. For the moment, at least, the imminent possibility of the Arabs capturing the new city had faded. However, the Jewish quarter failed to hold out, and on May 28th, the Jewish quarter surrendered. And here are Jewish refugees fleeing the Jewish quarter of the old city at that time. News of the fall of the old city was received with profound shock by the Yishuv. The loss of the Western Wall and the Temple site was lamented with bitterness for years to come. Now, the Arabs thus far had been unable to conquer the sprawling urban complex through direct assault. By the opening of June, however, the ability of the metropolitan area to hold out was far from certain. The prospect of mass starvation was very real. Ben-Gurion insisted that full military priority now be given to the opening of the Jerusalem highway. Yigal Alon was called down from the north on May 23rd to assume strategic responsibility for the assault on Latrun, the Arab strong point controlling the road. Now here is the Latrun situation. Here is Jerusalem. And then 18 miles to the west down the main road, we run into the strong point of Latrun, the Arab strong point of Latrun that was preventing any resupply of Jerusalem. Now, new recruits were needed. Manpower was needed to augment the Jewish forces. And so hundreds of recent immigrants possessing no military experience or even basic training were rushed up by bus and taxi from Tel Aviv. On May 25th, under the command of Colonel Shlomo Shamir, and here is Colonel Shamir, the attack was launched in a blistering desert, Khamsin. Khamsin is a hot southern wind coming out of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. Very hot and dry, very difficult to experience, much less fight in. Now, despite the lack of adequate reconnaissance or artillery support, the men were thrown into a direct frontal offensive. The Arab Legion's 4th Regiment, ensconced on the village heights, raked the attackers with mortars and artillery. Now, the Israelis were thrown back with heavy loss of life. During the next few days, additional efforts were mounted, each time with the same result, failure. Latrun very nearly became the graveyard of Jewish hope for breaking the siege of Jerusalem. It also very nearly became the graveyard of Ariel Sharon, who was to play such an important part in Israel's history. This is an article in the Times of Israel, January 12, 2014. The headline read, "Left for Dead in 1948, the Battle that Shaped Ariel Sharon." And a summary, Battalion Commander Sharon, 20, was shot in the abdomen and would have died, but for the heroism of a 16-year-old soldier, wounded himself, who dragged him through the Latrun killing fields to safety. And of course, Ariel Sharon would live, and we will encounter the tremendous contribution that he will make to the history of Israel as we get further along. Now, let's take a look at Latrun. This is the police fort at Latrun. You see it's a heavily fortified opponent, very difficult to take. Here are some Arab gunners at that police station firing down on the Jewish infantry advancing in the fields. Latrun now is the Armored Corps Museum. So if you go to Latrun these days, you will see all kinds of armored vehicles. Here is a Merkava on display. It's quite an interesting place to go. All right, the single alternative remained for opening the Jewish supply line. During the previous weeks, Colonel Mickey Marcus, an American Jewish volunteer and West Point graduate, serving as area commander for the road, had been using a path. He'd been using a path south of Latrun and the Deir Ayub section of the road to infiltrate troops on foot through the hills to Jerusalem. Now, the Dair, and you can read about Mickey Marcus in the book Cast the Giant Shadow, available on Amazon.com, and it was also made into a movie if you'd like to watch that. And here is a picture of the Arab roadblock on the Bab el-Wad, on the road there. The Dair Ayyub section of the road is also known as the Bab el-Wad, and you can see those some of those huge rocks on the foreground. It'd be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to bring a convoy along that road. It would have to be laborious effort would be made to have to clear the road. Now, Marcus speculated that the path he was using might be widened to enable vehicles to pass through. Now, here is that map again. Here we have Jerusalem, and 18 miles down the road, a little less than that, is the Dair Ayyub section of the road. This is a section that is totally controlled by the Arab armies, starting from Latrun. Now, Marcus speculated that this footpath that he had been using that bypassed the Dair Ayyub section of the road could be widened into a roadway so that trucks could be brought along this road. Now, with Yadin's approval, hundreds of laborers were now summoned from Tel Aviv and immediately put to work clearing boulders and dynamiting rock sidings. And so this work was named the Burma Road. And here it is under construction in this photograph. There was no opportunity to rest, even in the fierce deceit, for the United Nations truce was scheduled to come into effect, on June 11th, a United Nations truce. If the Burma Road was not completed before then, no further attempts would be permitted after the truce deadline, and Jerusalem would starve. On June 9th, a primitive roadbed was cut through the Jerusalem mountains, and the first trucks, loaded with cans of food and water, ventured out onto this makeshift highway. And here's a bulldozer towing one of those vehicles. This is some of the very steep sections of the road could not be conquered by the average vehicle. They had to be towed up using a bulldozer. And here comes a medical truck being towed up the road so they could get to Jerusalem. Here is a picture of a convoy regrouping at the end of the road, and you can see the guard keeping watch over the security of the convoy there. Several hours later, the convoy entered Jerusalem, where they were greeted rapturously by the waiting Jewish population. And here is a supply convoy entering Jerusalem. And of course, this is the Burma Road today. It's still kept in good condition, and Israelis like to walk this road on Independence Day in order to remember the tremendous contribution the Burma Road made to the raising of the siege of Jerusalem. And now we come to the first United Nations truce. The idea of a truce and the fighting was introduced and endorsed by the UN Security Council on May 20th. The chosen mediator was Count Folk Bernadette of Sweden. He arrived in Israel the following week. Unfortunately, he was later assassinated, and it is suspected that the Lehi, the Stern Gang, were the perpetrators. They were the same group that had assassinated Lord Moyne earlier. So Count Folk Bernadette came to a very unexpected end during his time as the mediator of the truce. Now, the Arabs were generally receptive to the idea of a truce, and all fighting was to stop on June 11th. Now, the truce descended on the exhausted armies as, quote, dew from heaven, in the words of one Israeli commander. Both sides were at the limit of their resources. Now, strategically, the Arabs had gained very little. The Syrians had established a bridgehead on Israeli territory, but it was a minimal one. The Arab Legion had taken the old city, but the achievement was of questionable military importance. The Egyptians had acquired a foothold in the Negev, but that was a barren desert. Whatever pretense a united command had ever existed among the Arab armies had disintegrated in the actual fighting. Abdullah, the Hashemite king, lost interest in continuing the war. Now, the other Arab leaders made a more effective use of the truce. The Iraqis increased their numbers at the front to 10,000 and added large quantities of equipment. The Syrians also carried out an extensive recruiting campaign, as did the Egyptians. And by the first week of July, the number of Arab regular troops in Israel had grown from 32,000 to some 45,000. Now, gravely short of manpower and weapons, the fledgling Israeli army actually was in danger of collapse on nearly every front. By the truce provisions, neither side was permitted to introduce new troops, but Jerusalem would be allowed enough food and water for a month, but no more. Well, the Israeli high command had no intention of abiding by these conditions. Of course, neither did the Arabs. They considered these conditions suicidal. So convoys of food and medicines were rushed to Jerusalem. Mobilization was continued and increased dramatically in early July. The little armaments factory moved into full production, turning out bullets, grenades, and mortar shells. Weapons were secretly unloaded at coastal sites. And by then, quantities of guns and equipment had become more substantial. On May 20th, the Czechoslovakian government turned over an entire military airfield to the Jews, which in the following months became Israel's principal base in Europe for the shuttle service of arms and planes. Eventually, several Dakota airplane transports commuted back and forth between the two nations, ferrying to Israel dismantled fighter planes, artillery pieces, armored vehicles, and lighter weapons and ammunition. In fact, here is an Aviva S-199. This is the first Israeli fighter aircraft that was brought into Israel. Planes arrived from other countries as well, including bombers and fighters flown illegally by veterans of the Allied Air Forces out of Britain and the United States. And here's a couple of Spitfires that were brought into the country for the Israeli Air Force. Thousands of tons of ammunition, military supplies, equipment, and clothing now arrived, much of it purchased, much of it donated from Jewish sources throughout the world. And here's an example. There's a Palmach Sherman tank that was brought into Israel. Amazing, just amazing. The French government also supported Israel. Weapons were sold in large quantities to the Jews. Training, storage, and assemblage facilities were provided near French arms depots and at abandoned French Air Force landing strips. Airfields in Corsica were made available to planes refueling en route to Israel. In Israel, Ben-Gurion was determined to impose unity and discipline on all levels of the military effort. Uniforms became standard, and a differential pay scale was established for commissioned officers. During the month-long truce, new recruits were given intensive training and new weapons were mastered. With 60,000 men in service and growing quantities of European and American equipment at its disposal, the army was systematically transformed into a modern fighting force. Here's an example of that more modern equipment that came to Israel in 30 days. This all happened in a month-long truce. It's kind of hard to believe, isn't it, that all this little nation with just a militia, would have a virtual modern army in 30 days. Now, this map shows the status after the first United Nations truce went into effect. The Israeli areas are in solid black, the solid black area of the areas controlled by the Israeli armies, just the black area. So political attempts to squeeze the state out of existence had failed. Remember, we had witnessed the shrinking Jewish state. Well, that did not occur. That had failed. Now a military attempt to squeeze the state out of existence had failed as well. My point, God is sovereign. In Israel, in order to be a realist, one must believe in miracles. And so now we come to the Israeli offensive. As the truce period approached, as the truce period approached its conclusion, the Egyptians prepared to strike the first blow. On July 8th, before the truce expired, General Naguib renewed the attack against Negba, which was the main cohesive element of the Israeli defense system in the south. And here are some troops, Israeli troops, in action in Negba. But Negba, too, had been reinforced with heavy equipment during the truce and now successfully hurled back repeated Egyptian assaults. Thereupon, the Jews themselves began a limited offensive, reoccupying a number of villages in the northwest corner of the Negev and forcing back the main Egyptian line in the center. It soon became evident to Yadin and his staff that the Egyptians were no longer representing a serious offensive threat. They would be dealt with at a more opportune time later. And here's just a generic troop of Israeli forces in action, perhaps being trained. But this, a picture of this militia being turned into an army. In the north, the Syrians were content to dig in at the captured farm settlement of Mishmar HaYarden. The presence of 2,000 Arab irregulars under Fazi al-Kawukji in the lower Galilee mountains was a more serious potential danger, and the Jews disposed of it, however, in a brutal week-long campaign during which they overran the Arab town of Nazareth and cleared the surrounding Arab villages. Again, here are some more Israeli forces in action. Here is a couple of soldiers setting up a mortar. At the same time, the principal Israeli military effort was concentrated in the Legion-occupied Lida Ramla area. This area also dominated Israel's major road junctions north, south, and east, west, including the opening of the Jerusalem corridor and entrance to the country's one major airport. On July 9th, Yigdal alone led two of his brigades in an attack on this Arab strongpoint. And again, here's a picture of Israeli forces in action. Some sort of a cannon being used there. In the course of a day and a night of fighting, the enemy positions were completely encircled. On the 11th, Lida and its international airport fell to Lieutenant Colonel Moshe Dayan's mechanized infantry. And here's a picture of the capture of the Lida airport. The following afternoon, Dayan led his column of jeeps into Ramla, barreling through the main street at full speed, machine guns firing. Dayan's troops sent the legions fleeing. With this sledgehammer operation, the Jews eliminated any remaining Arab threat to the Tel Aviv area. Now we come to the second UN truce. The UN Security Council unanimously endorsed a second ceasefire proposal on July 15th with instructions for hostilities to cease in 3 days. By July 18, Israel occupied far more land than the UN partition resolution had allocated, and the Arabs occupied only one Jewish settlement, Mishmar HaYarden, and the small Egyptian foothold in the Negev. And this is the status of the war after the second United Nations truce. These Israeli areas are now in solid black and in the dark gray, the cross-stitched section there. The Israeli areas have now increased from the solid black area to include the dark gray area. Now we come to the liberation of the Negev. In the last days before the imposition of the second truce, the Jews managed to recapture a number of villages in the northwestern corner of the Negev. Yet the majority of the Negev settlements still remained under Egyptian blockade. As Yadin and his staff viewed it, strategic consideration alone would have dictated a future Israeli offensive in the desert. It was agreed that the Egyptian danger was potentially the greatest, and the priority henceforth would be given to a full-scale offensive in the Negev. In preparation for the new offensive, Israeli transport planes ferried men and material to an airstrip carved out of the northern Negev. From August until October 1948, some 2,000 tons of equipment and 1,900 troops were carried down in this fashion. Under cover of darkness, the soldiers were able to infiltrate into the Negev kibbutzim until a full Israeli brigade was operating behind Egyptian lines. During that same period, Yigdal alone moved his veteran northern brigades southward. By mid-October, the young commander had 30,000 troops at his disposal on a single front, plus a small air fighter squadron. And he chafed impatiently to get to move on the offensive. Well, his opportunity came October 14th. With UN approval, the Israelis set out to provision their settlements by conducting an unarmed convoy across the Egyptian-controlled Fallujah crossroads. Now, here's a map of the area. Here is the Fallujah crossroads. Now, you can see the Jewish positions are in blue, and the Arab positions are that red line between the two Jewish sectors. And so there was a gap that had to be crossed. And this is where the convoy was heading. The convoy was heading across the Fallujah crossroads there. The moment the column drew within sight of the farms, the lead vehicles were blown to bits. Undetected by the UN observers, the Israelis themselves had dynamited the trucks. So armed with this pretext, this is the pretext he needed, Alon went into action immediately. The speed with which he now launched his offensive was a shattering surprise to the Egyptians. Soon, the major concentration of Egyptian troops in the Negev, some 35,000 men, faced the possibility of defeat or entrapment near Fallujah. The British introduced a resolution in the Security Council demanding yet another Palestine ceasefire, and the measure was adopted. During the next week of October 22nd, as the UN troops gradually settled over the desert, the Egyptians began evacuating units from the western Negev. This is the situation during the third United Nations truce. The Israeli areas are now solid black, dark gray, and light gray. So all the gray areas on this map, the Israelis are now in possession of. Now we come to the final campaigns of the War of Independence. As 1948 drew to a close, the Jews were making preparations to attack and to eradicate the Egyptian army's last remaining garrison in Israeli territory. The purpose was to establish the irrefutable fact of Israel's sovereign power and sovereign viability at the end of the war altogether. The object became Al-Aouja, the anchor of the Egyptian positions in the Negev Desert. And here is our map again. Here is Al-Aouja, down at the very bottom part of your map. If Al-Aouja fell, it would break the back of the Egyptian military effort. Al-Aouja was well protected by sizable Egyptian artillery and tank units, so a direct assault was hardly feasible. Now here are some of the troops in preparing for this attack. Yadin discovered a solution in his archaeological guide to Greco-Roman Israel. An ancient Roman road ran south of Al-Aouja. Under cover of darkness, engineers repaired the most difficult stretches on this ancient route of march. The work was completed with such uncanny silence that the Egyptian outposts less than 2 miles away remained completely unsuspecting. On the night of December 22nd, the offensive began. It was called Operation Horev. And here, of course, you can see Horev troops here. And here's another column of Horev troops ready to begin the assault. A column of half-tracks and troop carriers moved along the Roman road. At dawn, December 26th, the Jews were within firing range of Al-Aouja. And these Israelis were able to attack the defenders from behind. Although stunned, the Egyptians fought back courageously. And again, here's another column of Operation Horev troops being brought down into the desert in preparation for the assault. After a full day and a night of close quarter fighting, the Egyptians surrendered. Their colonel was still in his pajamas. The surprise attack had caught him in bed. And on the subject of prisoners, this is a column of his Egyptian prisoners being removed from one of the buildings of Al-Aouja. Israel went on to conduct raids across the international border into the Sinai itself. Now, the IDF had come further in 8 months of war than the limited distance of mere geographical advance. In May, their ill-armed little militia had faced Egyptian tanks only 16 miles from Tel Aviv. In December, now 7 months later, their battle-seasoned troops, supported by armor and fighter planes, were driving into Egypt and cutting the last exit routes of the Egyptian army. Help, however, came to a distraught Egypt. Under the terms of the 1936 Anglo-Egyptian Treaty, Britain was obligated to assist Egypt in the event of an attack from an outside party. So on December 29th, the Security Council ordered an immediate ceasefire in Israel. It called for a permanent armistice in all sectors of the area. Now was Britain's chance to revive its tenuous presence in the area. London chose this moment to deliver a warning. Unless Israel obeyed the Security Council resolutions, Britain would employ its forces in accordance with the Anglo-Egyptian Treaty. The ultimatum was a chilling one. Ben-Gurion didn't dare risk a confrontation with a great power. Yadin agreed. The Israeli armed forces had won too much to gamble with their victory now. On January 2, 1949, orders reached Yigdal Alon to withdraw his men from the Sinai. And here is a memorial to Operation Horeb set up in the desert. And this is the map we've been looking at of the third United Nations truth. But this map contains the area that we're discussing right here, the area of Operation Horeb. This is a close-up of it. This is the territory occupied by Israeli forces as a result of Operation Horeb, from which they withdrew during the early months of 1949. See, they had penetrated directly into across the international border into the Sinai, into Egyptian territory. This is the raising of the flag after Operation Uvda, which was the capture of Eilat. That was the last campaign of the IDF in 1948. And now, in 1949, ceasefire agreements are entered into with Egypt, Lebanon, Transjordan, and Syria. In January 1949, initial discussions opened between Israel and Egypt on the island of Rhodes. So here is the Mediterranean area. Here is Israel. To their west is Egypt. And up to the northwest is the little island of Rhodes, which was the neutral meeting point for these two governments, where they began their negotiations. As a first step, the armistice agreement was drawn on the basis of the existing military lines. Each side assumed that the armistice would be supplanted in the near future by a permanent peace treaty. It was signed on February 24, 1949. The precedent established at Rhodes was generally followed in subsequent negotiations between Israel and the Arab states. Once Egypt, the greatest Arab power, had agreed to a treaty with the Jews, it was much less difficult for others to follow. So the armistice, the ceasefire agreements, were reached with Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. They were all signed by July 20th. Iraq was the only Arab belligerent not to sign an armistice agreement directly with Israel. The agreements left Israel in possession of approximately 8,000 square miles of land, 21% more land than was allocated under the partition plan. Now, here's the armistice lines of 1949 to 1967. Israel is the light and dark blue areas. Jordanian occupied areas are in orange, and the Egyptian occupied areas are in red. Now, this is the armistice areas, and now this is the original area of the United Nations Resolution 181. Again, back to the armistice lines of 1949. You can see the Jewish state was to be in the blue, and the Arab state, Palestine, was to be in orange. So as you can see from the interposition of these two maps, that the Jewish state has gained quite a bit more territory, 21% more, and the Arab state has disappeared. The plans for an Arab state are gone. There was the planned Arab state right there, but it no longer exists. because the Jordanians occupy the West Bank and the Egyptians occupy the Gaza Strip. Here is the agreement with Jordan. Again, Israel is in light and dark blue. The area in orange is not a Palestinian state. It is Jordanian-occupied territory. And the red area is not a Palestinian state. It is the Egyptian-occupied territory. So the point I'm making, I think very clearly, is that no Palestinian state exists. A Jewish state exists, as according to the UN plan, but it consists of 21% more area than originally allotted by the UN. And the Palestinian state has disappeared. The Egyptians and the Jordanian occupy those areas and maintained control of those areas for many years. All right, it's now time to take a look at Program 3 in the DVD series Against All Odds, Shula, the Girl Who Became a Spy. Very, very incredible story by this woman. And you can read about her story in Shula, codenamed The Pearl, that's available on Amazon.com. And I would also suggest that you view Program number 6 in Against All Odds, The Miracle of 48. Israel now becomes a member of the UN. Following the Rhodes Armistice Agreements, Israel's application for membership in the UN was approved by the Security Council on March 11, 1949. Membership itself came in May, and here is the UN flag-raising ceremony. The flag of Israel is raised in the New York headquarters of the UN. In those days, admission to the world body was considered meaningful evidence of the nation's sovereign viability. Howard Zachar writes, "As the Israeli flag was ceremonially hoisted in the plaza of the General Assembly building, the Jewish world at large asked themselves whether only 4 years had passed since the Star of David had been identified primarily as the seal of doom worn by concentration camp inmates. Now it was the symbol of the State of Israel. The rise to independence of history's most cruelly ravaged peoples transcended the experience, even the power of description, of case-hardened journalists and social scientists alike. They were all amazed, awestruck, scratching their heads. How could this happen? It appeared somehow as if a new law of nature had been born." That's Zachar in his History of Israel on page 353. But we all know that this was not a new law of nature that had been born. This was a fulfillment of prophecy, the prophecies of the first regathering, Ezekiel 20, 33 through 38, Ezekiel 22, 17 through 22, Ezekiel 36, 22 through 24, and Zephaniah 2, verses 1 and 2. In Israel, in order to be a realist, one must believe in miracles. And so David Ben-Gurion became the prime minister. And again, you've seen this picture of Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion before. Chaim Weizmann became the first president of Israel. And here's a portrait of President Chaim Weizmann. And then the first Knesset opened. And this is an exterior view of the Knesset building. Now, the Israeli governmental system consists of a one-chamber legislature called a Knesset, elected by ballots cast for party lists rather than for individuals. The length of office for a Knesset is 4 years. Now, the Knesset consists of 120 seats. And here is the Knesset chamber. On the floor there, you can see the 120 seats. And in the balcony is the visitors' gallery. But this is the Knesset chamber. So each party list, therefore, contains names of 120 candidates. It is possible that one party could get all the votes and therefore take all the seats. So to cover that eventuality, each party list contains the names of 120 candidates. The Israeli voter has no right to strike out the name of any candidate on the list of his choice. In effect, the Israeli voters vote for party ideology rather than for individuals as such. If a political party received 50% of the votes, for example, they have thus won 60 seats in the Knesset, 50% of the seats, and the first 60 people on the party's list take office. Now, the order of listing is decided by the party's central committee and indicated party rank. The cabinet or the government is formed by the leader of the political party holding the largest number of Knesset seats. He is designated as prime minister and selects various ministerial colleagues. Now, there was a temporary and fundamental change in the system in 1996. In that particular election, Israeli voters voted directly for the prime minister. This was adopted in 1966, but rescinded in 2001. All right, 304,000 immigrants. In the 18 months following the Declaration of Independence, 340,000 Jews arrived in Israel. And your map summarizes the situation here. Jewish refugees came from Morocco, from Tunisia, from Algeria, from Libya, from Egypt, from Yemen, from Iraq, from Syria, and from Lebanon. No influx like it had been witnessed in modern times. Israel had issued an open-door policy to all Jewish people. Emotionally, the policy was dictated by the most fundamental of Zionist tenets. The extended back to the biblical promise and forward to the commitment in the Declaration of Independence that Israel would be open to the immigration of all Jews from all countries of their dispersion. And there was another, no less valid explanation for this unprecedented policy, and that was the government's acute recognition of the need for instant population. People were needed to deepen military manpower reserve, to settle the vulnerable empty spaces of the land, to start new agricultural colonies, and to create a modernized economy. This tidal wave of immigration was by no means motivated by a pioneering spirit. The newcomers received very little scrutiny or screening. The aged, the infirm, the weary, the disillusioned flooded in indiscriminately, seeking peace and security, not creative adventure. Okay, we now come to the airborne transfer of 50,000 Jews from Yemen to Israel. The Yemenites were the first to reinforce their numbers in Israel. The Imamate of Yemen lies on the southwestern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. It was the home of 50,000 Jewish people. And here is the map of the peninsula. There's the location of Yemen. Concentrated in and around the capital city of Sana'a, they trace their presence to the mass dispersion from the Holy Land after the Roman suppression, the Roman War. Their status as dhimmis, a barely tolerated minority, was the result of the Muslim conquest in the 7th century. Somehow they held fast to their Jewish traditions and continued to live in an unshakable expectation of the arrival of the Messiah, who would lead God's people back to the land of Israel. With Israel's independence in 1948, life in Yemen became suddenly very, very dangerous. Chagrined at the defeat of Arab forces on the battlefields of Israel and aroused by the opportunity to loot, the bands of Muslims swarmed through the Jewish quarters of Sana'a and in other towns as well, plundering and burning. Departure became a matter of survival. The Jewish Agency got involved, and the largest numbers of Yemenite Jews made their way on foot southward to the coast. From there, they were loaded onto American DC-4 airplanes and flown to Israel. And so flown from Yemen in the south to Israel in the north. At the peak of the airlift, known as Operation Magic Carpet, planes were flying round-the-clock schedules, 7 to 8 flights a day, transporting 200 people per plane load. And here is one of the Operation Magic Carpet aircraft. And if you went inside that aircraft, you'd find every seat filled with 200 Yemeni Jews flying home to Israel. All right, I see I only have maybe 30 seconds or so left. We'll pick it up next session in 1950. Where the Western powers guarantee the existing borders in the Middle East. So we'll pick it up. We'll pick up our class at that session, at that section next session. Thanks so much for being our students. We're so happy you joined us. We'll see you in 1950. Lehi Tzraot. Lehi Tzraot.